Welcome to Extroverted Developer, a new podcast about computer programming and technology in New York City. I'm Jim Wallace.
And I'm Ben Gunderson.
And today we have a special guest, Sean.
Hi, I'm Sean Cribbs. I work for Basho Technologies. I'm a software engineer. Basho is the creator of React, which is a distributed database of the NoSQL variety. We're here to talk about, you know, whatever.
Yeah,
no. That. So
Sean and I went to school together at the University of Tulsa. Kind of lost track of him for a few years until suddenly I moved to New York, and it turns out he lives like an hour from me. So we were like, "Why don't you come on down?"
Yeah, it was pretty exciting to find Ben was in the city, and that I'd be able to hook up with him again and you know, catch up, because we actually lived like right next door to each other in the same dorm.
We did, yeah, we were neighbors.
And, so that was for 3 years, yeah, So that was kind of neat, and. Interesting where life takes you.
Yeah, and absolutely. How long have you been in New York?
I live in New Jersey.
Okay.
But
we consider that part of New York. All the commutable places.
Practically New York. So I've been here for about 9 months.
Okay.
I'm enjoying it. I like being able to come into New York City, you know, a couple times a month just to interact with people in the city and go to meetups and stuff like that.
Yeah, the great meetup community around here. How long has Basho been around?
Basho has been around for, I can't put an exact date on it, but in its current form, this is probably approaching its fourth year.
Wow.
So the interesting thing is, in the first year, you're kind of stealth. The company took a really big pivot. They were originally like this sales training company, and they had a product that was... on Salesforce, you know. So,
okay, yeah.
Like, what happened was they realized, okay, this business is not working.
Okay.
And so they decided that they had already been building some interesting technology to run the Salesforce part of the business.
Mm-hmm.
And so they pivoted and focused on that technology and basically went from, you know, 50 or 60 people down to about 8. And then just started, you know, working on that technology and growing from there.
That's great. Like, that's the true, like, method of pivoting and all. This is before Lean Startups came out, right? And everybody's now pivot crazy.
Now, React is your core product. What else?
Yes.
Do you have other products as well?
So we provide a lot of open source software. React itself is open source.
Right.
We have an enterprise version, which has some kind of holdback features. But they're also kind of like features that people don't need unless they're in a really big deployment. And then they're going to want... you know, our top tier support anyway. So that's kind of how our product is structured. That's been our main product for the last 2 years. I'm coming up on 2 years at Basho now.
Okay.
And then we're branching into some other products now. Pretty soon we're going to release something probably later this month or early in March.
Right.
That's going to be, I think, a real game changer for people doing cloud deployments. So cool. It's going to be really interesting to see how that works out.
Nice.
For our listeners who've never heard of Basho, can you describe a bit more specifically about what your distributed database product is and what it does, what it's used for? Or...
Right. So React is an interesting product because it has its lineage, its history in... kind of an implementation of Amazon's Dynamo paper. So in 2006 or 2007, Amazon wrote this paper about a database system that they use to provide reliable, available storage to any number of their applications that are running in their huge data center deployments. And it's basically a key value store.
Mm-hmm.
In its heart, but it's fundamentally distributed. So you don't run just a single machine. You run multiple machines. And what this gives you is the ability to replicate across all those machines and to be able to scale horizontally across more machines as you add them. So if you need more capacity, you need more availability, you need a lower latency, you need higher throughput, you can just add more commodity machines. And they found that this is, especially with the We've all heard stories about like how much Facebook buys. They buy like containers,
yeah,
like
full
shipping
of machines,
containers
right.
full of machines.
This is why they're working so much on PHP compilers and things,
yeah.
so they can get
right.
the code to run a bit faster.
Right, and they buy commodity machines. They're not.
Yeah.
They're not buying like.
They're not Google writing their own
$60,000 boxes. Right.
Right.
They're buying shipping containers full of $2,000 or $3,000 boxes.
Okay.
But Amazon is a similar situation as far as I understand. They're kind of tight-lipped about it, not as mm-hmm. much as Facebook, but. The design of Dynamo and the design of React is really well suited for those types of deployments where you just need to add capacity over time in an incremental fashion, and you don't, you have a consistent machine style. You don't need to get a bigger and bigger box to handle your database. You just like add another rack full of servers
okay.
or something.
That seems to be the way that the LAMP stack is going in general, is to scale horizontally, whereas I think the Microsoft solution is to get big iron, big hardware.
Right.
Stack Overflow famously runs on one or two boxes that are just huge. Like you said, they add...
Right.
So,
well, 37 Signals famously uses like only one or two servers for Basecamp too, I believe, and they just get bigger. They just increase the size.
More memory, more processors.
Right, they had this picture of like... their terabyte of RAM
right.
sitting on the table. Like, yeah,
and they just
this is
mem cache everything,
awesome, so.
And they just make it run as fast as humanly mm-hmm. possible, so they never have to shard it. I guess that's a.
So the interesting thing is, I think that their type of application is very different from what we see people using React for.
Okay.
So I think, at least for the listeners, it would help to have a good example. It's in the top five under social networking in the App Store. It's called Voxer.
Okay.
It's this walkie-talkie app for the iPhone and for Android. Maybe we can like try it out later. But so what's great about it is the application itself is really simple, and they use React for storing both metadata about their users. About the messages they've received, they have like a timeline for every user in the system, and then they also store their audio messages and their text messages and their photo messages all in React. And this is probably with the exception of one other, I'm thinking this is probably our largest deployment of React in production right now. So the interesting thing about that is those are all different data types.
Yeah, right. Audio, video,
right,
text.
Right. So 37 Signals has apps that are very like focused on the relational database.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the data there is text, and for the other things they tend to store files on like S3 or something like that. But the interesting thing about React is it doesn't care about what your data type is.
I see. So you're storing the file binary in
yes.
React. You're not like pointing to just a file location.
No, it's not taking whatever you send it and putting it on the file system. It's actually storing it alongside anything else you might have.
Oh,
stored.
That's great.
which is really nice for those kinds of applications where you're not exactly sure what your use cases are going to be and you want to evolve mm-hmm. it quickly. You're not tied to, I've got to have this huge distributed file system thing like, Gluster or have like a SAN with NFS mounts or mm-hmm. something like that. That in terms of operations, that piece is kind of removed, and you just have a React cluster which works like an HTTP server. So you can basically connect it to any language,
mm-hmm.
any development framework you're using, and then you can just treat it like an HTTP server where you can store things in it too.
Okay.
In addition to just fetching them. And then you can talk to any node in the cluster to do the request. It's not like you have to say, okay, tell me which
node to go to for this one.
Right? It'll just take the request and go, okay, I know exactly where this thing you're asking for.
Every machine knows where every other shard
right.
of data is.
So does right. it expose a REST API kind of like CouchDB or?
Yeah. So in a way it does. It doesn't have a notion of what the format of your data is. So you basically tell React, here, I'm storing an image. But internally, it just says, okay, I've got this metadata about this value, which includes the content type, because it's a proper HTTP
right.
server. And then it just like captures the body as the value that you're fetching
and
image.
Like
it ignores the
base 64
of it.
Encodes? Or?
No, it doesn't need a base 64 encode. It just treats it as a binary
binary
and ships it around. Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, I mean, eventually they're all just ones and zeros, and you're just trying to get them from here to there, right?
Right.
Yeah. Yay, finally, something simple. Like.
Right. So the interesting thing is that, you know, one of big CouchDB's big features is that you can host HTML and JavaScript and CSS applications in the database. So you can do that with React, too. But you don't have to define a design document. You just say, I'm going to store this HTML file here, you know, under this bucket and key, because you know, React is a key value store, but it has buckets for namespacing.
Okay.
You say, I'm going to put it under this bucket and key, and I'm going to point all of the CSS and the JavaScript and the other you know things I need to serve this application to other places in React, and it just works. So it's actually more like a pure HTTP server that lets you store whatever you want in there. And you don't have to think about attachments as an additional part of your document. You don't have to be constrained to your document needs to be JSON. It can be whatever you want.
So you can treat it like a file system.
Yes.
Yeah, it sounds like essentially an HTTP distributed file system where you don't care where it goes. Like,
I think that's a great way to think about it.
Yeah.
And there's a bunch of other features in there if you're you know doing things that are other than key value. But for the most part, our largest customers and open source users use it primarily as a key value store because they've gotten to the scale where they need to denormalize their in order to scale out their application. They're no longer able to think of things as tightly interrelated like you do in a relational database.
So when people are deploying this, are they typically deploying it out to S3? Or they have their own hardware for this?
People tend to run their own hardware. Some of our customers and open source users are on EC2. It's an easy way to get started. But I'd say an increasing number of people are also using Joyent, which we're a software partner with Joyent.
Okay.
So you can actually just you know go to Joyent and buy 3 React machines, and they'll spin them up in their cloud, and you don't have to do much else.
That's cool.
So Basho is not based in New Jersey, though.
No, Basho is not based in New Jersey. We are historically based in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Okay.
But we also have
all those wicked smart people.
Yeah.
And everyone works remotely, or most of the offices?
Most people work remotely, yeah. Okay. We have offices in Reston and also in San Francisco.
How many employees?
We're approaching 70 employees now.
Wow. Okay.
Which is amazing because when I started, there were maybe 12. I was like number 12 or something.
Nice.
I'm not sure the exact number, but it was really small at that time. So it's been a growing experience.
Lots of stock options, I hope. No.
I'm not talking about that.
Yeah, no. Still, Jim and I are big about being, you know, well paid as developers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think.
Well, and Basho doesn't skimp. I mean,
right.
we've been really keen on hiring the best. But even more than just having people that are, you know, competent at their work is to have people that are passionate about their work. And I think that's like the defining characteristic of who we look for. If you're not passionate about your work, if you're just kind of like, oh, this is just something I do, then we don't want to hire you.
How do you maintain the culture across remote boundaries, I guess?
It is a challenge. And I think our culture is evolving, too. But for the most part, we find as many ways to continue interacting, even though we work remotely. So we have a Jabber server, which we use to talk between individuals in the company, as well as have chat rooms that we host. There's one, a main chat room for basically everybody, and then people break off into other chat rooms as they need to.
We started using HipChat for something much like
that. Yeah, we started doing that similarly, but we don't have enough people working remotely that it really.
And even the one or two people that we do have working remotely aren't part of the chat room to begin with.
I thought it was a huge success, and then suddenly a total failure.
Well, yeah, and I think that those tools are really key for remote workers. I just recently transitioned to being a software engineer. Before, I was what we call a developer advocate, which is kind of a jack-of-all-trades person, but their primary responsibilities are client services, so support for customers, as well as maintaining things like documentation and internal tools that need to run the support organization.
And you still speak pretty regularly on behalf of...
Yes. And you know, that's been something that has actually been more my impetus than actually the company saying, you should go talk about React. And it's that I started talking about it when I started at Basho, and I just continued, and I kind of became a conference junkie. I probably went to 10 or 12 last year. So.
Nice. They're fun. Talking at conferences is a lot of fun.
What's your favorite conference so far?
Oh my goodness, that is really hard to say. You know, my lingua franca of programming is Ruby, so I really enjoyed RubyConf in New Orleans this year. It was my first time at RubyConf, but I think as far as interdisciplinary conferences, the best one I've been to so far has probably been Strange Loop, which is in St. Louis.
Okay,
and it had basically like all the most awesome people you can think of in in computer software were there, including there was Rich Hickey, the creator of Clojure. There was Gerald Sussman, the creator of Scheme and the author of the SICP book. and then there were authors of basically every kind of cutting edge language and a development tool that you see primarily kind of open source focused, but just in general about what's on the cutting edge of computer technology right now.
It's great that we have sort of rock star celebrity. I love those Intel commercials that were like, our rock stars are different from your rock stars.
Yeah.
And it's just like some
those
guy
commercials,
with a badge, and right. It's like inventor of the USB, and that girls have his name like on their notebooks and stuff with little hearts, and I was like, yes. More of that.
Yes.
Yeah, I started to go down the route of talking about how we communicate. So, in addition to having that company Jabber server, we also have man an IRC room to help our customers and open source users, which also kind of serves as a point of just socialization with other developers in the community, which is really nice. And then for the client services team, which I used to be a part of. And for our customers, we have Campfire, which provides a little bit more interactive. We mentioned 37 Signals earlier. It's a 37 Signals product.
Mm-hmm.
And it has some similarities to HipChat, of course. When I was in client services, we would communicate by posting funny cat pictures in the chat room. And,
That's funny. That's how we use the chat room, too.
That's right.
We use HubeBot to grab the funny cat pictures.
We set up our own HubeBot. But the HubeBot, we actually had some interesting things with that, too. So we have other online tools to help us in our process as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we hooked our HubeBot up to our Agile Zen Kanban board. Agile Zen is a Rally product. It used to be kind of an independent company. Just to keep track of tasks that we're working on and make sure that we're trying to do a poll-based flow for support tasks, we had Agile Zen Kanban board. And we could ask HubeBot, what tasks are ready to pull?
Mm-hmm.
Or what are the tasks that I have open on the board? And that was really simple because, it's just a, HTTP API with JSON and things. Mm-hmm. But that was really helpful for also, keeping track of who's the on-call person or people this week.
Mm.
In addition to Agile Zen for tracking, which we also have in the engineering team right now, the platform team specifically uses Agile Zen. We're looking at some other tools to improve the process. But we also have daily sync calls about support issues and professional services, things that are coming up. And it's at noon Eastern, which is okay for most everybody.
Okay.
It's not great for me because I like to take lunch, but... but then, also the people who live on the West Coast are, it's 9 a.m., so they barely came to work. And then we have a developer in the UK, and it's, like 5 or 6 p.m. For him.
So he does it from the pub, yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny how the culture of, when you start work is so different from the, West Coast to the East Coast. And I'm sure it's, it goes back to the stock exchange bell and everything. But when I was in L.A., I got to work at like 7 in the morning and everyone started bailing around 4, and that's just the way everyone did it, and everyone went out to happy hours started at 5. New York happy hours go till 9 or
I think it's also a New York thing too, because I've noticed since I moved here that if I was going to be nomading at somebody's office, some acquaintance or friend's office, while I came up into the city for some other thing.
Like city maps. Huh.
If I said I was going to be there at 9, they'd be like, whoa.
Yeah, I'm not going
to
be there.
I'm not going to be there until 10 or 10:30. Right. And that was really strange to me, because I'm a morning person. When I work from home, I get up at 8 and, I'm at my desk by 9 with a carafe of coffee our people at the office in Cambridge are also that way. They're up early and they go home at 4.
Right.
And
we're from the Midwest, and so we're really used to getting up around 7 or 8, and then and everyone starts around 9. And when I was in L.A., I got up at 5 in the morning, got on a bus.
I don't understand how you do that and stay out to the bar until 4 a.m.
Well, you didn't. You got back from the bar by midnight or so, and most of the bars closed at like 1 or 2 in L.A. because that's just when everyone was done. And then you got up kind of with the sun.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Yeah, I don't miss that. I like the 4 a.m.
Well, in that way, New York is different from other places.
Yeah,
for sure.
And everyone gets into work at 10:30.
Yay! Yeah. I also like that. I love New York.
I like being the first person in the office, though. I usually try to
get a lot of work done,
like 8:30, and then I've got like 2 hours to just I don't know. I get a lot of my productivity comes in those 2 hours.
I had a question about the Agile Zen board. Mm-hmm. Do you actually have project due dates?
So, from a organizational perspective, we do, but since we're building a product and we're not consulting, the flow is a lot different. And what we try to do is say, here have a larger planning session. Here's what we want in the next release. Everybody goes out and does it, and as they complete things, their peers will review the code.
Okay.
And that's part of our Kanban processes. There's a ready column which says this is the director of engineering or the platform manager, whoever is setting it up, says here's what I want worked on next.
The last thing I want to talk to you about, while you create a distributed database system, mm-hmm. but you use distributed version control to do that, specifically use Git and GitHub, and I was hoping you could walk us through a little bit about how you use distributed version control with your remote team, mm-hmm. and how GitHub flows into that.
Sure. So when I joined the company, we actually started on Mercurial, which is fairly similar to mm-hmm. Git.
Yeah.
Depending on who you talk to, they'll say it has a better user interface. But
I started with Mercurial as well, but it was because of Joel Spolsky and his HG init. Like, it just seemed much more approachable to Windows developers than Git did. Is that similar to your experience?
Yeah, so Mercurial is, I think, a lot easier to understand. However, the interesting thing about my personal background in that is that I had come from Subversion directly to Git, mm-hmm. And I started using GitHub within like 4 months of when they started. So I believe that was,
you should get a sticker.
Oh, I have one. Like, if you go to coderwall.com. I don't know if you've seen that.
I have that.
Yeah, I have the whole.
All right, we'll put that in the show notes.
So I had already the interesting thing I think that about distributed version control, which is really beneficial, is. And we saw this in general when we moved from Mercurial, specifically, and Bitbucket, mm-hmm. Over to GitHub, which was kind of toward the end of 2010 when we switched. The same thing happened to Basho's products as what happened to some of the open source things I'd been working on before I started at Basho, when we moved from Subversion to Git.
Okay.
Which is basically that, and it's not necessarily Git itself, mm-hmm. Although like some of the technical aspects of it kind of promote this sort of development, but it was that the publicity of being on GitHub and the ease with which you can fork a project, make changes, submit them back to the original code owner is really, it's remarkable how easy that is, mm-hmm. and that it's totally democratizing. So
so the community sort of latched on.
Absolutely.
Immediately.
And then, and people, even if they're not actually contributing anything, they're like, oh, this is an interesting project. I'm going to watch it, or I'm going to fork it. Mm-hmm. And then they get information about what we're doing.
Code commits suddenly are not so quiet, as we found out today.
Yeah.
Our CEO emailed us that I had forked a Lemonade, and I added a feature and did a pull request. Shows up in Google search when you search for city maps.
Right.
My comment upon that code check-in. I had no idea.
So what that means for us nowadays is that we've actually for all of the open source projects that we have, which include our core product,
mm-hmm.
We do all of our code review on GitHub. So a developer, when he goes to work on a new feature or on a bug fix, he'll pull down the latest
master. Okay.
Yeah. And then he'll create a branch, which is just specifically for that topic. And we tend to tag it with some kind of other identifier, like is this an issue in our Bugzilla tracker?
Okay, so you do it for every issue
now. So, okay. But we have historically had Bugzilla.
I see. So you branch for every bug fix, not just every feature.
Okay. Every feature, every bug fix, we branch for.
Okay.
Nobody pushes directly a master, which is kind of based on the I don't know if you've seen the Git flow.
I saw how GitHub uses GitHub to code GitHub.
Yeah.
The most meta thing on the internet.
So somebody will work on a bug fix or work on a feature, and they'll be pushing their changes up to this branch. Or they may just work on them locally. There's no, not really, really forceful about, you have to push all your code up. What tends to happen is they'll do 2 or 3, 4 commits, maybe at most,
mm-hmm.
and then they'll open a pull request, and they'll describe everything they changed. They'll describe, how many reviewers they want. Like, if it's a particularly complicated portion of code that they're changing, they'll say, "Well, I want 2 reviewers or 3 reviewers on this, just for sanity's sake."
Okay.
People tend to develop, we don't do pair programming. A lot of shops do, but we have never really integrated that. Instead, we do code review, and we do automated testing, and all that is kind of hooked into our GitHub workflow. So when somebody sends a pull request, then they go in our Kanban board and say, "Hey, this is ready to pull," and they put a link to the pull request in the comment of the card on the Kanban board.
Yep.
I love able to do that. Even being able to link to a pull request. Yeah.
And then, in addition to being all of the development being public to everybody in our company, it's also public to whoever's watching.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's this particular issue that they're concerned about, they can watch for pull requests related to that issue or comment on a pull request. And we've actually had some of our customers who tend to be on the more savvy side send us code or a comment on code that we're working on and say, "Hey, you might want to do this differently because of such and such." And that is, I think that's really empowering, and it actually makes the community feel like they're involved, even though the majority of the people working on the product are inside the company.
For a long time, open source felt very church tower. What's the expression where it's up on a hill?
The cathedral.
The cathedral on the hill, or the ivory tower on the hill, where it was very inaccessible,
mm-hmm.
Unless you, knew a guy, and then you could get your polls.
Right, and this is a great way. I think to GitHub specifically, the total openness with how mm-hmm. everything happens and like how much visibility you have into it, I think it makes even really open organizations like the Apache Foundation look pretty ridiculous and closed,
mm-hmm.
OrgNU for that matter. But it really promotes conversation. And as a company with developers who are primarily remote, what we need is conversation about the code.
Mm-hmm.
We do need the direct interaction of, I'm chatting with my, my coworkers on the chat room, but just to be able to talk about the code and not do these, kind of like Inquisition panel style code reviews, to say like, "I'm going to do a small change. I'm going to let some peer review it. And then it's going to move through and be merged into the main product," means that we actually move forward more quickly and in a more reliable fashion.
Have you had difficulties with like business or marketing folks who are concerned about like competition or concerned that someone else is going to just branch your project and create a company of their own based on something, or even just like marketing a new feature when you're making all these commits for this new feature and they're like, "Well, we don't want anyone to know about this until..."
Yeah, so we have kind of done that in a very instance specific sense. The core of our product and the majority of what we do is open source, and we want to keep it that way. And whenever we have a new feature come up, we think really hard, about why it shouldn't be open source. Because for the most time, most of the times, it's like, yeah, it's going to be open source. We even talked about this new feature that came out in our latest release, which just happened to be this past week, is a kind of, you know, graphical user interface web-based thing that lets you control your React cluster. And previous to that, the predecessor of that feature was always closed source. And now it's open, and we decided that, yes, in order for this to move forward, in order for to increase adoption, to increase ease of use, this needs to be public. And the interesting thing is that we found that when people use the open source software and they see that it's this good, and I don't have to get the enterprise edition to have something worth using, mm-hmm. then they actually don't feel as bad about buying a license and saying, yeah, I want the support. I want somebody to call when, you know, I have a problem late at night or whatever.
Right.
Or I want somebody to consult with me on how to use this. And they know that they can get it right away and they can try it out with very little risk. And that's, I think that's a big selling point. It feels kind of, you know, grassroots in terms of marketing.
Well, especially since your product essentially is marketed to and consumed by developers.
Absolutely.
Unlike, for example, the CityMac product is for you know, regular average shows. But if right. you're marketing to developers, I think they might actually be comforted by the fact that something's open source, you know, especially NoSQL hacker types. Who,
right.
You know.
It means that we're also, we have a compelling reason to be more honest about our product. About its pros and about its cons. It's really interesting to see how there's a dialogue there. And, you know, although we're at times concerned about people getting upset or having a backlash, most of the time people are like, no, we appreciate that you're honest, even though, you know, your product isn't perfect all the
right.
time.
Yeah.
So they do a pull request, mm-hmm. and then who brings that into master?
So what tends to happen is even after they send the pull request. So a peer, you know, one of the other developers will review it. They'll run the tests. They'll do, you know, any manual testing that needs to happen.
Okay.
And they'll do that
on their own machine, or
they'll
do
that on their own machine.
Okay.
We also, you know, have some machines in a co-location facility that we can, you know, log in via VPN and do some testing there. But generally, people do it on their own machines. We also, you know, each of the developers has a separate kind of server-style machine
okay.
in their home or office or wherever they're working that they can use that doesn't have to be their laptop.
Mm-hmm.
So they do all the testing as it calls for, and then they, you know, give the thumbs up or they give feedback about, hey, you might want to change this or I ran into this bug. And then it kind of begins this loop until both parties are satisfied, and then it'll move into test automation phase. So we, in addition to the unit tests that are included in mm-hmm. our code, and the functional integration tests that are in there, we have a larger kind of regression suite that's run separately. And so depending on what the change being made is, we'll make a new test case for that larger regression suite.
Mm-hmm.
And then that piece of code will be reviewed, and then
the test
by someone else.
Code.
The test,
okay.
yeah, itself will be reviewed, and then finally everything gets merged in.
How do you run that larger test suite? Somebody also runs that on their local computer?
Yeah.
Okay.
So actually, we do a lot with virtualization. So
okay.
what they'll tend to do is, because that's supposed to be kind of like black box type
right.
of testing, what they'll do is spin up some virtual machines running whatever operating system we support. And we tend to test across 5 or 6 operating systems.
Okay.
Basically, like, I think 5 distributions of Linux, and then we also have Solaris that we test on. And then we'll, you know, verify that the test that was given runs and it makes sense, you know, like the basic code review sanity checks. But there's also a huge suite of things that we built over time that we can run against the changed code to find any regressions or any new interesting bugs that can be triggered by those existing tests.
Okay, so you don't have continuous integration in a sense that every check-in runs through all of these,
so,
except for one person does it manually.
Yeah, so I think We actually do, but it's not used in that same sense. We have BuildBot, which is a Python-based project. We use that primarily for building packages. So we build nightlies as well as building, you know, the actual releases, and then you can build specific branches on demand. But that doesn't run the regression suite.
That just does the building.
Sanity check. Run the unit tests. Build it on this platform. You know.
Okay.
Basic stuff like that.
So you don't know if somebody broke the build until that night.
Potentially, but we have, at least historically, we're working to try to change this because we're realizing that it's not scaling as we get more people and more complicated software.
Okay.
But we have typically done, before release, we'll freeze any new additions, new feature additions. Mm-hmm. Bug fixes can come in, but we'll basically freeze a number of weeks before the projected release date.
Okay.
And then people will work on, let's get those tests running on all the platforms. Let's find any last-minute bugs, especially data loss bugs. You know, we pride ourselves on being a durable, available database. If there's any possibility for data loss, those bugs get in right away.
Okay.
Get
fixed right away.
And then there's other, you know, things that it depends on the platform manager, the engineering manager to decide which bugs get actually applied to a release.
Oh, interesting.
Which bug fixes. So we're trying to fix that. The hard thing about our product is that because it's clustered by default, you know, you don't usually run a single one. It's kind of a combinatorial explosion problem. Mm. When you run it on multiple machines, you're going to run into all kinds of strange things. And how do you create tests? You know, even just like sanity check tests that make sure that something in a distributed fashion works.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a challenge that we're going to try to tackle over the next year, but we don't have a continuous integration in the traditional sense.
Okay.
Yeah, sometimes we do pro tips at the end of the
Yeah, I forgot
podcast.
To mention that.
You got any little Git hacks or...
My pro tip is... there's a feature of Git called submodules. I don't know if you run into them.
Oh, yeah. I use submodules in our repositories.
Great. So one of my best things, especially for GitHub, is if you have like a make target or something that will generate API documentation for your project or you know any other kind of documentation you might want to generate, set that up so that the directory it generates to in your project is actually a submodule that points to the GitHub pages, the gh-pages. Branch on your repository. And then when you generate the documentation, it generates in that directory. You go in that directory, you commit, you push, and then your documentation is up
on the web.
Yeah.
Great.
Nice.
And so we're starting to do that on some of our projects, and it's really working out well.
That's awesome. Great pro tip. Love it.
My pro tip for the week is actually a little Dropbox feature I just discovered, which is, first of all, Dropbox can be used for kind of a very simple version control in that if you enable the pack rat feature, there's a little pack rat feature you can sign up for if you get a pro account, which lets you have normally on Dropbox you have 30 days of previous versions. It'll keep previous versions for 30 days. Pack rat does it indefinitely, so you can just go back and like see every previous version of a document. The feature that I discovered that was interesting is dropbox.com/events, which is a feed and a feed that you can get via RSS of every change that's made to a particular Dropbox, and so you can actually subscribe to everything that happens inside your own Dropbox. Which is, I'm not sure if anybody else does that on the box.net or anybody else does that, but that's going to come in handy one of these days.
Yeah, no doubt.
But yeah, awesome.
All right, Sean. So thank you very much, Sean, for being a guest this week, and that does it for this week's Extroverted Developer.